Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Marigold Clothing, making fashion fun since 1989, in Broad Ripple, featuring women's clothing, gifts, and accessories, and committed to customer service. More on Facebook or at marigoldclothing.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy. Welcome to You Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on You Drink Indiana Radio, we have got a lineup that covers a lot of aspects of Indy's local food scene. First, we're focusing on the food scene itself. We'll talk with Hannah Lindgren, who spent the past 2 years working on Food First, a documentary about local food in Indianapolis. We'll also talk today with Master Gardener Joellen Myers-Sharp of HoosierGardener.com about what you can do in your own garden right now. Then we'll talk with J.R. Roseman of Some of This, Some of That, formerly a food truck and now a brick-and-mortar location at 24th and College Avenue. And we'll hear from one of the building's owners, Alan Lindsay, about the neighborhood as well. And finally, we'll hear about a new ramen shop that's open in Carmel, Kazuki Ramen and Ezekiah, when we talk with local franchise owner Samantha Yeep and culinary director Jasmine Lau. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. When health problems led local media company owner Hannah Lindgren to begin focusing on eating better, she began learning more about Indy's local food scene, and that led to her efforts to document the changes to the city's food culture. Her documentary, Food First, explores those changes from a variety of perspectives, all tied to local food. Hannah held a preview this past week for the film, which will be released in June, and I caught up with the filmmaker before the event to hear what the project is all about.
Food First is a feature-length documentary film about Indy's food story. And that's all facets of the food story in Indy, from access and our food desert problems that we have, like a lot of cities our size, all the way up to the fact that we have just an amazing amount of local restaurants with some fantastic food.
Now, how did you come to the idea to do this? You know, what was the motivation for doing a documentary?
I have a lot of personal motivation for doing this film. I, about 6 years ago, got pretty sick, and it just turned out that all of it was related to my digestive system. And so once we found out that I had a bunch of intolerances and I had to completely change my diet and my whole way of thinking about food, slowly my whole outlook on food changed.
And how so? How did it change?
Well, I just became a lot more conscious of what I was putting into my body. Before, you know, I just focused on, oh, what do I enjoy eating, or what's fast and convenient, or what is my mom cooking for me? but then when I, you know, especially when I graduated college and it was entirely my own choice, I had to really, you know, be choosy about, am I going to buy organic or conventional? What is the difference? I had to educate myself. Am I going to try and grow my own? I ended up, you know, I have a huge garden. So I just got a lot of education out of it. And a lot of that came through just the filming process and listening to people while we were interviewing them.
How did the filming process start? Where did you begin the story about what's going on in Indianapolis?
Well, I had been kind of toying with doing a film about my own story and just kind of my own trying to figure out how to eat. But then I was introduced to Wendell Fowler, who's a chef and a speaker here. And then he told me, oh, you should meet Audrey Barron. She's opening this raw vegan cafe, and it's going to be the first one in Indy. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know what raw vegan was. So I met with Audrey, and that was March of 2014. And then from there, we just decided, okay, we don't know what the complete story is going to be, but Ezra's is compelling. Let's just start following their story. So we filmed all the way through construction to opening, and during that whole process, we got introduced to a lot of different people, because we got introduced to the people who were growing the things that Ezra's was going to use. And after we got introduced to the people who are growing things, then we got introduced to all of the different ways that food is distributed throughout the city, to grocery stores, to restaurants, to, you know, even to your door. So there, it just kind of spread out from there like a web.
Was there anything that was surprising about all these things that you were learning?
The most surprising part was that they are all interconnected. I think a lot of people look at the issues like they're completely separate things. You know, that food deserts is a thing, that people don't have access to food, or that, oh yeah, we have great restaurants or we have great local grocery stores, but they don't really think about how they're connected, even though, you know, the through line is food. But really, they all rely upon each other in some way, and they all require each other to exist. So it was just really fascinating to see, honestly, the story unfold itself and just show it how it was all interconnected without me even really having to try. So
where are some of the places that you went? You know, what are some of the restaurants or the businesses or the farms that you were filming along the way?
Yeah, so we, for each sort of section or topic in the film, we kind of focused in on one organization or business that we felt was representative of others like it or what was happening in Indy. And that just was because if we tried to focus on too many, it would water down the point. By the time we got introducing what each place was, we would have to move on. So we felt like we should go in depth more with them. So, like, for example, with the education piece and learning about how to, like, a lot of people take raw vegetables and they don't know what to do with it because they might not have that experience of cooking at home. Well, places like Growing Places Indy are doing that. They're teaching kids at a young level how to cook food and how to do it nutritiously. And then we have Ezra's Enlightened Cafe in Broad Ripple. Obviously, they're the ones we started with, so they're the restaurant that we focused the most on. We also wanted to have a representative of, you know, vegetarian or vegan versus non. So for the one that we focused on in the growing food section, we focused on Tyner Pond Farm, which is a protein farm in Greenfield. And then we have some other places sprinkled in there, like Good Earth and Pogue's Run, which are two grocery stores we focus on. And we look a little bit at green bean delivery and other sort of alternative ways to get your groceries. We look at community gardens in general. And yeah, that's most of them.
What was the reaction from some of the people that you approached to feature in the documentary? You know, they're busy doing their work. What did they say when you approached them?
Yeah, they're all tremendously busy. That is definitely a common denominator among all of these businesses and organizations. So they were all very gracious in letting us intrude a little bit into their time. Mostly we just said, can we stick a mic on you and follow you around? Can we just come and, you know, you just tell us when you're working and we'll come get it. The only time that we needed to set aside was the interview time, which usually took less than an hour or so. They were gracious enough to give us that time.
Now, are you in the documentary itself?
I am not. No, I decided pretty early on that I wasn't going to be part of it, mostly because there are so many great people in the food story in Indianapolis that there's no reason for me to be in there when you have all these amazing people. And then secondly, it just, you know, everyone's food story is different and how they get to there. And I didn't feel like, even though mine is a common story of people getting sick or, you know, finding that thing that prompts them to make a change, I didn't feel like it needed to be the thing that we talked about. There are a lot of different ways you can get to that point in your life where you want to make a change.
Well, now tell me a little bit about your media company and what you do in, you know, your regular job, right?
Yeah, so I own Deliberate Media, which I started shortly after graduating in 2013. And we are a storytelling company. So we tell short stories for clients that are organizations, businesses, community groups, really anyone who has a story to tell. And we believe that's everyone. but we approach the storytelling and the video from a storytelling angle, from the point of view that the best way to get across what you do or what you sell is through telling your story. That's the most emotionally impactful way to do it. And the best way to do that is through video, in our opinion. So we make short videos. A lot of them are less than 3 minutes, and they'll usually be used online some way. So maybe Facebook advertising, or even just put on Facebook or on websites. We do a lot of what we call business trailers. So it's telling a story, but it basically tells the story of your business in a way that's nice, short and sweet, to the point, and people can kind of get a feel for who you are.
Now tell me a little bit about details of the film, you know, how long it's going to be, when it'll be released, and how people can find out more information.
Yeah, so the film will be a little bit over an hour and 10 minutes, so it's not that long. And the reason why we didn't make it very long is because each of our six initial screenings this summer are going to be followed by a community conversation. And that's because we never created this film as a way to self-promote or as a way to make money. We did the opposite. It was all because, you know, we're passionate about what's happening in Indianapolis, and we believe the story needs to be told. And we believe that the more people hear about it and learn about it, the more they'll be involved and the more changes they'll make, or the more they'll participate in the movement. So we want to have these conversations after each screening, where we'll have a panel of experts on the topic and open it up to discussion with the audience. And each screening, depending on who we're partnering with, will be on a different topic covered in the film. There's obviously no way that we could include everything that's going on in Indianapolis in the food scene in this short film. So this is a way to expand upon it within each of those topics. So, for example, our first screening will be at Tyner Pond Farm, and the discussion afterward will focus on growing practices and making growing local economical. And then we're partnering with Eskenazi Health for a screening at Eskenazi Hospital, and theirs is going to be focused on their whole idea of food as preventative medicine, and their Sky Farm and everything. The Sky Farm is included in the film as well. And then Indy Food Council is going to be hosting a screening, and conversation will be about food as economic development for the city. So, you know, each one, so you can kind of like pick and choose. What do you want to hear even more about afterward? And what conversation do you want to participate in? And that's the screening you should go to, so that afterward you can be involved in that.
And the screenings start this summer, right?
Yes, the first screening is June 11th. And then there's three more pretty quick back to back. We're looking at late July for the last two. So it's June and July.
And people can follow you on social media, I assume?
Yes, we are on Facebook mainly. So it's facebook.com/foodfirstfilm. And you can follow us on there. We are currently posting a lot of quotes from the film, so you can kind of get an idea of who's featured and what they're saying and what we're trying to say with the film. So those are pretty shareable images, and we'd appreciate it if you would do that.
We've been talking with filmmaker Hannah Lindgren of Deliberate Media about her documentary, Food First. For more information on the film, you can find it on Facebook or check out deliberatemediallc.com. It might not be as warm as we want it to be, but it is April now, and it's definitely spring. The grass is greening up, trees are blooming, and some of us are just itching to get out and dig in the garden. And the garden centers are starting to oblige our spring fever with tempting plants just begging to be set out. But is it really time yet? That is the question. For a little advice on what to plant when, we're talking today with Master Gardener Joellen Meyer Sharp of HoosierGardener.com, who fills us in on whether there's anything we can get done in the garden right now.
We can make sure that any plants that were left in the garden from last fall, that those are pulled out and put in the compost pile. If you have a cover crop, if you've grown a legume cover crop or a winter rye cover crop, you want to make sure that that's harvested or turned under or cut back so that it can start to decompose so that the bed will be ready then for planting in a few weeks. But right now, if your bed's ready or you've got a nice flower pot or a window box, you can start lettuces. just sow the seeds. I mean, with lettuces, you barely have to say dirt and they're good to go, you know, and they're also quite shade tolerant. So people who have a lot of shade, lettuces, microgreens, mesclins, those are all things that we can sow now.
Like right outside.
Right outside.
Even if they're, you know, even if it's cold and...
Yes, even if it's cold. Main thing is you don't want to walk on your beds because things are still pretty wet. And so you don't want to like be composting or not composting, but compacting the soil or anything like that. And so, yes, you can do that. And so you wouldn't be compacting the soil in your window box because you wouldn't be walking on that.
So if I have a window box, I can start doing some things with it. So I have a few things that are in the window box that, you know, seem to winter over. Thyme, I think, is what really worked out the best for me in my window box this year.
Now, thyme is a perennial herb. It can stay evergreen, so you can harvest it in the wintertime sometimes because the leaves will be there. If it's already in the window box, then you can just trim it back a little bit, give it, you know, tidy it up, and then sow your seeds right around that, and it'll be fine. In the garden itself, you can sow seeds for carrots, radishes, spinach, what else, like other cool season crops and things like that. And in a couple weeks indoors, we'll be starting seeds for tomatoes and peppers and melons, eggplant, and things like that.
So when you start them indoors, what are we going for? Because, you know, the temptation is to put the seeds in now and get them going, and then they grow, but I don't know. Tell me what I'm looking for starting seeds indoors.
Well, I actually write about this in the Indianapolis Star this weekend and on my website, HoosierGardener.com. But the main, I think, downfall for most people starting plants indoors is, one, they start them too early.
Well, that's the temptation, right, to just jump in and do it right now.
Right, especially because we had that warm spell and everyone got so hyped about that. But you want to start them about 4 to 6 weeks before they would be transplanted outside. These plants are transplanted outside after the last frost, which in general here is around Mother's Day. That's sort of the target day that we can start moving some of our warmer season plants outdoors. The other problem with starting plants indoors is that there's a lack of light. So people put them in a nice little tray, stick it in a sunny window, and, you know, the seeds germinate. They're oh so happy. And then all of a sudden the seedlings are like 6 inches long, and they're like two leaves at the top of this little stem that's stretched. They call that stretched because it's trying to grow toward the light. And it's better to have what they call ambient light, so that there's light all around the plant rather than just on one side of the plant. If you have them just light on one side of the plant, like a south window, you need to rotate the seed containers, you know, where you've got your seeds planted, you know, every day probably.
Because this is what happens then to my plants. They get very tall, you know. So then what happens when you put those tall, leggy plants outside?
Well, they're tall and leggy. And, you know, sometimes you can get around it with tomatoes because you can plant tomatoes deeper than they were growing, for one thing. So you can sometimes solve that. But usually the stems are weaker and they may be more susceptible to wind damage, to being broken in the wind, to fungus diseases and things like that. So even though you might have that bright sunny window on the south, most gardeners rely on secondary light so that they have like a shop light with fluorescent bulbs in it, and they keep that light really close, like just a few inches away from the seedlings that are growing. And then as the seedlings grow, they raise the light. So, you know, invest in a nice shop light, a couple of bulbs, and a chain, and, you know, use that supplemental light, and I think you'll be a whole lot happier. The other thing is that some people don't realize is that you need heat in order for seeds to germinate. And yes, there is some heat that comes from the top down when you've got them in a sunny window or under lights. But most successful gardeners use what's called a heat mat or a seed starting mat.
And underneath, right?
Underneath, yes, underneath. So you put your trays of the sown seeds on top of this mat, and it just keeps that soil really nice and warm and promotes good seed germination. I don't have one of those. When I grew a lot of seeds, I used my son's waterbed because he had gone away to school and there was enough heat coming off of that. You know, that's what I use. So if you have a waterbed, you might make that work.
So I guess that's part of the problem when we try to put things out too early is that the soil isn't warm enough.
Exactly. And tomatoes and peppers, especially eggplants, anything in that family, they're just going to sit there and be miserable in really cold soil. So even though we say you can put stuff out May the 10th, if the soil really isn't warm enough, you know, they're just going to be unhappy and sit there until the soil warms up for them to grow. And a lot of smart gardeners you can put tomatoes out slightly earlier than you can put peppers out. So if you hold off putting your peppers out till maybe the end of May, they'll get a better kickstart when they go out there.
That's a long time to wait. Can you tell people to do this? I know that you work in a garden store. Do you see people who just can't stand it and they put them out anyway?
Yes. Yes, we do. And, you know, what we say to them is we're happy to sell you another batch of tomatoes after these are killed by the cold, you know?
So I wanted to talk just a little bit about microgreens. You mentioned some microgreens, you know, because I see them a lot these days at the farmers markets. And I wondered if that's something that people can grow easily at home because, you know, they are pretty pricey.
Yes, they are pricey. And we definitely want to support the farmers Absolutely. At the farmers markets. But, you know, they are easy to grow your own. They're in that lettuce family, but they also have other, you know, so you might have like mini cabbages or mini Brussels sprout leaves and things like that that'll be in that mix of microgreens. And usually they germinate within a week to 10 days. Once the plants are about 1.5 to 2 inches tall, you can actually, what a lot of people do is they snip them off with scissors, and then the plant may develop some more leaves so that you get a little bit of a second crop on it, depending on what that particular seed is. But they're in that lettuce or in that greens family, which are just, you know, say dirt, and the seeds are going to germinate. And again, microgreens are like, you know, can go in shadier areas, so you don't need to have that huge, bright, sunny spot. And those probably would be better grown in a container of some kind because they're so small, you know, that animals could step on them or you could actually accidentally kick it or step on it because they're pretty tiny. But, you know, there are some new tomatoes. So if people are interested, they can go to the All America Selections website, which is all-americanselection.org, and look at some of those. They can also visit the fairgrounds at the demonstration, the Master Gardener Demonstration Garden, which is free to get in to see that if you tell people you're going to the garden. In a few weeks, they'll begin planting there, probably around the end of April or so.
We've been talking with Master Gardener and garden writer Joellen Meyer Sharp. You can find her latest columns and lots of other gardening info at HoosierGardener.com. Years ago, when Indy's food truck scene was starting to get a lot of attention, the show Eat Street came to town to film some segments, and I got the chance to be on the show talking about some of our food trucks. One of those trucks was known as Sot-Sot. The letters stand for some of this, some of that. And that's when I met J.R. Roseman of Sot-Sot. Well, fast forward to 2016, and J.R. has taken his Sot-Sot concept of creative Cajun food and created a brick-and-mortar location at 24th and College in Indianapolis. You'll recognize the building by the massive safe door that leads to a bar called Reclamation Indy that's opening later this spring. But Sot-Sot is in the building as well, and I stopped by to talk with JR and one of the building owners, Alan Lindsay of Black Opal Investment Group, about the building, the neighborhood, and about the new Sot-Sot location.
You know, our interactions with a lot of the people in the neighborhood, you know, there's this basic services, grocery stores, you know, you hear the term, quote, food deserts, where there's not really healthy alternatives for food and some of the what I'll call economically depressed neighborhoods. So there's that demand for that. Just services, dry cleaning, even cultural. You know, we've had folks who have come up who are artists and photographers and painters who said, you know, I'd love to have some more in this area to showcase, you know, our work, or even build that community spirit where I can share ideas and thoughts with others who share that. So it has really been, you know, as you talk to these people more and you really get to understand what they want to see in a neighborhood and community, you realize that a lot of that is not here locally. So that's what we're hoping to do with this building. We know we can't be all to everyone, but definitely we hope to serve some of those needs as much as possible.
That's Alan Lindsay of Black Opal Investment Group.
You know, I saw it, and the first thing that came to my mind was the term beautifully flawed. It's an old building with a lot of character, rich history, just the people in the neighborhood. And that's what I keep coming back to. The community here is just a very diverse and caring neighborhood. And I experienced that day one of coming down and looking at this building. So shortly met Jerome after that. And, of course, not being an Indiana native, Jerome quickly educated me on the history of this area and what has taken place. And I fell in love at that point in time. So it's really been exciting for us. It's been very interesting. And every time we come down here, we're meeting someone new or getting different types of requests. So we're loving it, really enjoying it.
SatSat's J.R. Roseman tells us his vision for the space.
The vision for the space is authentic. It's not made up. It's just raw in its rawest state. But to be able to take that rawness and give it elegance. And the elegance really lies in the rawness and the experience to be able to come here. And once you have that experience, it'll hit you in the middle of the night when you sleep, you know. And that is the connection, to be accessible on the main vein in the city. You really couldn't think that, or you really wouldn't think that this is here. And it's in a neighborhood with a lot of walkers, joggers, you know, and to be able to take that and have it available. I saw the space, and I said to myself, my friend had directed me here, and I said, I can't see it. I walked away. It actually took six times. And the sixth time, in the middle of the night, I came over here and I looked again, and I said, what I want to do is create a space that's established, not you go in strip mallish, and nothing's wrong with strip mallish or anything, but that's not the concept I was looking for the brand that already has, is a staple in the city. Mm-hmm. I felt like the city deserved a better experience than that. You know, like I kept giving them newness, you know, I kept giving them excitement. So why would I do anything different? Why wouldn't I keep that going? And as soon as they think they could peg JR, the thing is, I give them something that they never saw coming. And I say that very humble. To be able to take this space and initially look at it in its rawness and just go home and category by category, like not overthink each section, you know, like, okay, let's just deal with the kitchen first, you know, and not try to worry about the counter or the walls yet, you know, let's just deal with the kitchen. And then out of each step in that process, every time I would try to overthink, I would be pulled back to that particular thing that I needed to focus on. And when it was time to get to that, I would be able to, I don't know, like an artist getting plugged into the wall, I would be able to, like, be used as a tool, something greater than myself.
Oh, I love that. That's great.
Yeah, something greater than myself. And to be able to sit back, I sit here and I'm in awe of what has become. I still, every day when I come here, I'm like, oh, my God, I cannot believe that I had the ability to be, and being in touch with the ability, you never know your abilities until you pushed. You know, until you are pushed, that's when you find out how great you really are. You know, you can't really, I'm just great, sit back and, you know, you can't do that. You have to actually get out there, move in it, take a chance, jump off the cliff. Sometime you got to jump.
Now, as for the menu, JR fills us in on some of the SatSat specialties that will be on the menu again.
We call it a loaded lamb bacon grilled cheese. It started out when when the mobile kitchen used to do breweries, they would want something quick but easy to walk around, you know. And I was giving them the regular menu, but at the same time, I wanted to create that excitement because I was showing up every week. You know, they would call me every week, but I had to keep giving them something new other than, it's Wednesday, there go JR. You know, like, you know, so something, I said, I'm going to do a grilled cheese. And then I started looking around and thinking, I said, you know what, we got to create some excitement today, you know, and let's load it up. And I said, you know, I was already cross-branding with a couple other businesses mm-hmm. in the community on that truck. And I would have, you might see the Flying Cupcake on the truck. You might see Goose the Market prepackaged goods where it was just, it would create the attachment to the truck. Like, let's see what's on there, you know, this week. So the lamb bacon, Goose the Market. I said, wow, let me forge a relationship with them. We did. And I said, the only way I can really do this, you know, really a bacon grilled cheese is great, but I love lamb. You know, let's see how that worked. And they lined up.
That's great.
The public spoke. The public spoke. You know, they gave me the ability to present it to them, and then they spoke. And I keep that one on the truck. So it's always been one of those things that we kept on the truck. And even when we put the menu on the shelf and put the brand on the shelf and the trucks on the shelf, we always kept that. So, like, when we talk about those categories, it's time to start thinking about the menu. Now the dining room is done, the kitchen is done. Let's talk about the menu. Let's talk about the staples, but let's talk about the excitement that we couldn't load up on the truck because, you know, in the truck it was like real estate. It was very precious. You couldn't have a bunch of everything. You just had to keep it like sizable. So it came to the point of looking at the menu and I said, you know what, I got to pull out the lamb bacon. I called Goose up. I said, hey, you guys, I don't know if you remember me. Oh yeah, we remember you, you know, like you used to buy all the lamb bacon, right? And I said, that's great. I said, well, we're going to start this thing up. I said, we'll open the brick and mortar and brick and mortar, where at? I said, 24th and College. Oh, the building with the safe. Yeah, they knew. They like, oh, the building. We can't wait. We're so excited for you. Hey, first case on us. Bam. Right? You know, that investment. It's the community investing. We remember they know that the relationship is going to go long down the, you know, and they just a couple blocks over. So it's not like it's a war. It's like, welcome to the neighborhood, brother. You know, it's like welcoming. So that's kind of how that happened. And, you know, just bringing it back together, it is just as great as it wants to be. I also offer a vegetarian version of it also, where I use a roasted shiitake and oyster mushrooms instead of, you know, the bacon. So the vegetarian options are here, no problem.
Now tell me what else we're looking at. Something else is very, very interesting.
Well, I made a lemon. I have breaded gator tail. Which is an appetizer or a bite. And people love gator.
Now, why is that? That's so unusual for here, right?
You know, I guess it's the exoticness of being able to say, hey, I ate gator. And really, it's the taste and, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but it tastes just like chicken. So, you know, so a lot of people like to say they want to take a chance, but they're scared. You know, they want to take it. Well, they say it tastes like chicken, so I'll... No, and then they find out that they love it.
We've been talking with J.R. Roseman, who is opening a brick-and-mortar location based on his popular Sot Sot food truck at 24th and College Avenue. We'll be back with more from J.R. here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Food truck scene has grown exponentially since the show Eat Street filmed here 4 years ago. One of the trucks featured on that program was Some of This, Some of That, or Sot Sot. But the food truck market got increasingly crowded, and some, like Sot Sot's J.R. Roseman, got out of the business, but only temporarily as it turned out. J.R. is now back in business with a brick-and-mortar location of Sot Sot, which is opening April 8th in a historic building at 24th and College Avenue. J.R. tells us about what he's been up to, how the business has come full circle, and what will be on the new Sot-Sot menu.
A lot of the staples from the truck, like I said, are there, the jambalayas and everything. But it was things that I couldn't bring, the oysters and the gator and etouffees and, you know, the bourbon chickens. You know, I couldn't bring that on the truck because there was no room. And things like that, that, you know, that we're bringing in. And what we're doing is looking at the recipes that we were using then and seeing how we can give it that thing where the people that knew the old recipes were looking at, oh my God, this is improved. You know, what we're doing, you know, when we're on a truck, we had different margins and things like that. So now we got artisan bakers baking us fresh breads and baguettes, and we're bringing that in. You know, we're kicking that product up, you know, because they deserve that. You know, it's something like, it's almost like a marriage. You know, I have to keep showing the public why they are investing in me. Mm-hmm. I'm not just content with what we have, but I want to give them a better experience. That's pretty much what we do.
Looking back, so 4 years ago when mm-hmm. Eat Street came to town and was filming, there was a lot of excitement about the food trucks. It was all kind of new here in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But now tell me a little bit about what's been going on since then, you know, kind of catch people up on this progression.
Well, part of it was, you know, with anything, you have to go, you have to look at things and how they're running, and you look at numbers and you look at progression. And you know, I saw something in the city that was going on, a lot of saturation. Saw a lot of exploitation in the industry, you know, and it was sort of leaving, you know, a bad taste in my mouth. Wasn't that I didn't love what I was doing, but in anything, you have to look for a way to improve your quality of life, the things that get you up in the morning, make you exciting, you know, give you the purpose. And at the time, I had two trucks out in the city, and you know, running after the trucks and keeping those things maintained. You know, at first it became a personal challenge, you know, because it was like, we did one truck. Now, can you do two? You know, you can do it, JR. You know, and here I am. I'm running two trucks, and I'm looking, and I'm saying to myself, you know, my family and my kids, they're taking their trucks and they're doing what they're supposed to do, and they're very productive. Mm-hmm. But in that, there's a season. There's a season where, you know, it gets cold and you have to say, you know, everybody go in, the food truck's not working, and my kids, they went and got real jobs, you know. And not that the food truck wasn't, but, you know, they needed that stability throughout the season. And so I said, you know what, I had created another market of business that I was in. I actually went from just being an operator and taking the experience and start servicing the industry and start building in the industry. Mm-hmm. So I started building trucks and I started, you know, keeping the trucks out on the road. And that gave me a new experience. And what I developed was a mobile concession solution company. And I took that and it gave me like purpose. I was still in food service. I was still keeping them out there, you know, and moving. And, you know, so the truck thing kind of like faded away, you know. And I said, you know what? Believe it or not, I took the truck, took my menu, took my brand, and I sold the trucks. And all that to come back around full circle. This is a circle of completion. I will tell you this, all right? This is a circle of completion. I sold that to get those businesses started. Once those businesses started to start flourishing, somehow I end up, you know, my heart was still always in something about food, that instant gratification. When I put that in front of you and you go, oh, that's delicious. I'm an addict for that instant gratification. So that was still in the back of my mind and in my heart. And That's what drove me to start looking for a location, you know, an establishment where people could come. And for it to be really create the, not that we always here, but, you know, like that weekend situation, that Thursday through Sunday situation, where you build up that anticipation, like, oh, I can't wait till the weekend come. I'm going to go over on college, and it's the ambiance, the experience, the building, the aura, the neighborhood, all those things. It's repurposing. But it's still the hardcore of the desire, that instant gratification, that getting a family some really good food, you know, and being able to, you know, just stay a staple in the community, still keep my brand there. The brand is still in the city, and we never left. We just went to the lab, you know. That's how we did. We went to the lab, came up with a greater formula, you know, and here it is. Before I could expose it, I had to make sure it worked for the city that's been, you know, I'm really, here's my perception. I'm really a facilitator. This actually belongs to the city. The brand belongs to the city. And I'm just grateful that they continue to let me be a facilitator. So before I expose them to the next product, I have to make sure I do my homework. And now we're at that time. We're about to cross over the bridge, you know. We're about to cross over the bridge. So we're excited.
Tell me when it's going to open and that sort of thing, the hours.
Our grand opening is April 8th, 2016. We're going to open from 11 to 8, Thursday through Saturday. Then Sunday we'll do 11 to 6. And then that's it. We'll cut it off, you know, recoup, and get ready to do it again the next week.
We've been talking with J.R. Rosemont of Some of This, Some of That, which opens April 8th at 25th and College Avenue. For more information, look for SotSot on Facebook and Twitter. When it comes to food trends, it seems that nothing right now is as hot as ramen. Chefs are putting it on their menus. Indy's seen an independent ramen shop, Ramen Ray, open this year. And now the area has its first ramen chain. Based in Japan, a locally owned franchise of Kazuki Ramen and Izakaya has opened at 2450 East 146th Street. Now, this isn't the instant ramen you remember from college. This is broth that cooks for hours and hours with fresh noodles, and it's just something that has to be experienced. To find out more about ramen and the new restaurant, I stopped in at the busy shop recently and talked with the owner, local anesthesiologist Samantha Yeep, about why she decided to open Kazuki and why the area is ready for ramen.
I just really like food, and especially ramen is, in particular, just a good bowl of hot noodle. It seems easy, but I mean, if you eat a really good, authentic bowl of hot noodle, it really is just really just so ridiculously good. So I just wanted something like that available, not just for me, but for Indianapolis as well. I think that it's good. But partly for my benefit too. I just think that having a good authentic ramen store will just be such a great addition to the city. I really do. And I definitely think that Indy, with the way that the food culture has gone, being so diverse, and people are just so open to a lot of different cuisine right now, that the city is absolutely ready for an authentic ramen restaurant.
Now, tell me how you researched this particular franchise, and why that one?
Yeah, so I did a lot of internet search before I decide on anything. So I sort of look into the different ramen franchise that will actually, you know, open within the U.S. And so I flew out to Seattle a year ago and try out a few different stores, because most of them, Seattle is actually a very big food city, so a lot of them actually have a store in Seattle. So I went and tried out a few of them, and I just really like the way that Kazuki runs their business. I really like the diversity of their menu. They have a lot of different ramen, which means a lot of different broth for the ramen, so you can get a very good variety of different ramen. And after sort of trying out and just talking to the people there that who owns the franchise, we settled on Kazuki because I just really like the way that the business is run and the quality of the food. Yeah.
Now, for people who might not be quite so familiar with ramen, if you could just describe it a little bit, because it's more than just noodle soup, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of people still think of ramen as like the, you know, the instant noodle that you eat in college where you just pour the hot water into the cup. That's not how the Japanese view ramen at all. That's just how I think we view ramen here in college days. So a true bowl of ramen, like from the authentic Japanese standpoint, is basically the broth, which is why I say kintsugi is great in terms of it has a lot of different broth. So the broth is what makes a good ramen. And the broth itself is such a long process to prepare, actually. So a good ramen, like what we do here, we actually have to roast the bone first. So you roast the bone. After you roast it, then you cook the bone. And in what we call chare, so it's kind of like a base of the ramen, and you cook it for more than 10 hours in order to produce the flavor of the broth. So a really good bowl of ramen is a broth that actually tastes so sweet and so rich because it has been cooked for so long, yeah.
Now, what about the noodles? That's a significant part of the whole experience, right?
Yes. So, once again, unlike the dried noodle you get in the ramen cup, a fresh noodle is very important for a ramen restaurant. So all our noodles are actually fresh noodles that we bring in, but they're all fresh and never frozen noodle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, what can people expect when they come in? Because they can pick what type of ramen they want.
Yeah, so when they look at our menu here, they are going to see a lot of different broth based on their preference. The pork broth, which is called tonkatsu, is probably the most popular one. It's basically, once again, the bone that has been roasted. It's cooked for more than 10 hours with all the chari, all the broth ingredient. And what you will see is that it tastes very, very rich because of the marrow from the bone. And then we also have chicken broth for people who doesn't like pork, we definitely have that as well. So the chicken broth is used cooked with chicken bone. And then we also have what we call a shio broth. Shio is basically a salt base. So it's used, we use sea salt and we cook that as a salt base. And then shoyu, which is soy sauce. So a shoyu ramen will be soy sauce base. And then we also have miso ramen, which is miso base. So all of this soup has been cooked for hours and hours to enhance the flavor, but it's actually totally, absolutely different base. And then we also have one option for people who are actually always into vegetarian stuff. So we have a vegan ramen as well, and the broth is made from all sorts of vegetables. Surprisingly, it's really, really good because it could boil in all sorts of different veggies, and it really turns out really well. Yeah.
Is there anything, you know, specific that, that you could tell me about this particular franchise, you know, and what makes it different maybe from some of the other ramen that people might be familiar with?
For sure, like just based on here in Indy, this is the only franchise that is directly from Japan. So you definitely, in fact, our chari come in from Japan directly from the headquarters there. So you're going to get the very authentic flavor that the Japanese get in Japan as well. Definitely not any store here in town at all that has a similar concept of something that is authentic from Japan. What makes this franchise really good as well is, like I said, just the variety of the broth that you can get. There are some sort of just local places here that might sell sort of a little bit of ramen, but definitely not the variety of broth and also sort of the amount of work, like I said, the 10 hours, 12 hours that you put in to cook the broth.
Jasmine Lau, partner and culinary director for Kazuki Ramen and Izakaya USA, formerly called Kukai, tells us how she helped bring the Japan-based chain to the U.S. and what she learned at ramen school.
4.5 years ago, we decided we wanted to bring ramen, authentic ramen, from Japan to the United States. So the first thing we thought about was creating our own brand. So I went to ramen school for that, and I learned how to make many, many different kinds of ramen and all that. But after I went to the school, I realized, you know, how complex it is. It's really difficult.
You know, what was that like, studying how to make it?
It was really, really a good experience. So it's very intense. It's from morning to night, like 7 a.m. to midnight, however long it takes you to finish your broth, you know.
So tell me about, you know, what the philosophy is.
So I went through the whole ramen school. You know, I learned how to make the noodles, the broth, and all the different toppings and all that for many varieties of ramen. And we could have created our own recipes and created, you know, our own ramen and all of that. And it would have tasted already better than whatever we had in America at that time. But we, you know, my partners and I, we are from Asia and we grew up eating ramen. And we knew what really good ramen was like. And what we made was good, but it was not as good as we wanted it to be. So then we started searching for ramen brands and trying all sorts of different ramen brands. And then eventually we found Kukai in Japan that we really liked. And that's why we, you know, requested to bring them to America. So that's how we ended up with a brand from Japan instead of creating our own brand. If you know the Japanese people, they are really fanatical about detail and very precise about detail. So originally ramen came from China, but it's the Japanese who really took it to the next level and refined it. So they are really particular about all the small little details, and I think that's why it makes authentic Japanese ramen so good. And, you know, it's about the temperature of the broth and what type of fish you're using, what type of kelp you're using and all that. They care a lot about the details. So that's why we import a lot of ingredients from Japan, because we tried to find substitutes in America and none of them really measured up to what we wanted. You know, it might be a small difference and most people would feel like, oh, it's not noticeable. But, you know, to us, we care a lot about even that little bit of difference.
We've been talking with Samantha Yip and Jasmine Lau of Kazuki Ramen and Izakaya. For more information, go to kazuki.com or look for the Carmel location on Facebook. This is Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 and WFYI.org. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. And thanks also to our guests, Hannah Lindgren of Deliberate Media and the documentary Food First, Joellen Meyer-Sharp of HoosierGardener.com, J.R. Roseman of Some of This, Some of That, and Alan Lindsay of Black Opal Investment Group, and Samantha Yip and Jasmine Lau of Kazuki Ramen and Izakaya. And thanks to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.